three key counterintelligence challenges: trust, paranoia, and technology. Counterintelligence faces three major challenges. The first is trusting too much, which makes warning signs hard to see and traitors hard to stop. The second is trusting too little, which can breed debilitating paranoia that ruins careers and casts wrongful doubt on good intelligence. The third challenge comes from advances in technology, which can create new vulnerabilities and enable insider threats to operate at vastly greater speeds and scale. Trusting too much. Every organization trusts its own people, and intelligence agencies in some ways trust their employees more than most. Security procedures, the mission, and secrecy tend to breed a close sense of camaraderie and a false sense of comfort that make it hard to see or report red flags when a colleague is breaking bad. Guards, guns, and gates serve as a physical dividing line between insiders and outsiders. Nobody just walks into the CIA or NSA headquarters. There's a zone of trust inside, and then there's everywhere else. What's more, every employee, whether it's the director or the janitor, must be investigated, vetted, and cleared before the first day on the job, a process that can take months, even years. Cleared employees also must undergo periodic reinvestigations. These security procedures are necessary, but they can have the unintended effect of providing reassurance that lowers the guard. In addition, as discussed in Chapter 4, working in an intelligence agency is not a job, it's a mission. The sense of shared purpose breeds strong bonds and a natural insularity that secrecy reinforces. Intelligence work is more dangerous and more insulated than the average day job, giving rise to a clubby culture that leans toward trusting insiders, even in the face of evidence that something big seems amiss. The perils of trusting too much were brought home to the CIA in 1994, when Aldrich Ames, a veteran case officer, was arrested as he drove his Jaguar to work. Ames soon confessed to having spied for the Soviet Union for nearly a decade, compromising more than 100 American and Allied intelligence operations, passing thousands of secret documents, which he carried in shopping bags to dinners with his Russian handlers, and blowing the covers of every important Soviet intelligence officer working for the United States. Ames's treachery led to the execution of at least 10 Soviet sources of the CIA and FBI. The most important of them was General Dmitry Polyakov, codenamed Top Hat, who served as a senior officer in Soviet military intelligence while sending secrets about Soviet moles, weapon systems, and more to his American handlers for two decades. Top Hat supplied hard evidence of the Sino-Soviet split that President Nixon leveraged to make his opening to China in 1972. Top Hat's intelligence about Soviet anti-tank missiles enabled American forces to defeat them when they were used by Iraq in the 1991 Gulf War. And his intelligence was voluminous, filling 25 file drawers at CIA headquarters. "It was like Christmas whenever his packages arrived," said one CIA officer. Former CIA Director James Woolsey called Top Hat the jewel in the crown of Cold War spies. After Ames revealed Polyakov's identity as an American spy, the Russian was arrested and on March 15, 1988, executed. Nobody knows where he is buried. As CIA veterans Sandra Grimes and Jean Vertefe wrote, "The loss of this man was inexpressible to those who supported the operation and to many CIA officers who never met him. Polyakov never asked for money. He spied out of conviction. His years of service and his contributions had become a legend inside Langley." Perhaps most upsetting about the entire ordeal was the fact that Ames's betrayal was not difficult to pull off. This was no super spy who worked tirelessly to hide his activities and outwit his CIA colleagues at every turn. Ames was a flagrantly incompetent case officer who routinely violated security policies and received poor performance reviews while serving in some of the CIA's most important Soviet and counterintelligence offices abroad and at headquarters. Frequently rated toward the bottom of his cohort, Ames was described as lazy, careless, weak, a bad leader, and unsuited for operations overseas. He forgot to lock his office safe and failed to submit reports about his contacts with Soviet officials. He once lost a briefcase filled with classified papers in a New York subway. He was personally and professionally sloppy. One annual performance review noted that his clothes were disheveled and his teeth were rotting. Ames was also an alcoholic who often came back from lunch too drunk to work. He once passed out in a gutter in Rome until local police found him and took him to a hospital. In Mexico City, he got into a traffic accident while so inebriated that he couldn't answer police questions or recognize the American embassy officer sent to help him. Even the KGB warned Ames about his drinking. Yet while his struggle with alcohol dogged him for years across multiple assignments, Ames's CIA superiors never seriously counseled him, disciplined him, reprimanded him, or moved him into less sensitive positions. As a bipartisan Senate Intelligence Committee review concluded, obviously, something went terribly wrong. Ames clearly had serious suitability problems from the beginning of his CIA career. Supervisors were aware of his personal and professional deficiencies, but did not make his problems part of his official record, nor act effectively to correct them, the study concluded. Counterintelligence red flags about Ames were obvious but went unreported and unaddressed. After Ames began spying for the Soviets in 1985, his lifestyle changed considerably. In 1986, while stationed in Rome, the normally shabby Ames started wearing expensive Italian suits and Gucci watches and began jetting off to European cities with his new wife, Rosario. Everyone in the office noticed that he seemed to have a lot of money. One officer described his spending as blatantly excessive. When Ames moved back to Langley, he started driving Jaguars, moved into a fancy $540,000 house, and hired a maid. Ames later admitted, "I didn't conceal my funds in any real way. I sloshed my money around pretty good." His spending clearly exceeded his government salary, but nothing was ever put in his file. One CIA officer, after a visit to his house, reported him to the Counterintelligence Center, but a cursory investigation was opened and quickly closed. Why did Ames go undetected for so long by so many? And why was a boozy incompetent ever put in positions inside the CIA's Soviet division and counterintelligence branch that gave him access to some of the nation's most important secrets? Trust was a major factor. On June 13, 1985, when Ames assembled his first cache of secrets for the KGB, he stuffed 6 pounds of classified documents into his briefcase and just walked out the door. Nobody searched him as he left CIA headquarters. According to New York Times reporters Tim Weiner, David Johnston, and Neil A. Lewis, the agency had stopped searching employees a few years earlier. "Trust was the watchword of the day," they wrote. Words like fraternity, brotherhood, and club were often used to describe the CIA's tight-knit, largely male, national clandestine service where Ames worked. Trust in the brotherhood made it unthinkable that one of their own could be spying for the enemy. Trust in the brotherhood also fostered a deep reluctance to confront or report a colleague, no matter how incompetent or suspicious his conduct. The Senate Intelligence Committee's review concluded, "All too often, an officer who has been through training, gone through the polygraph examination, and had an overseas assignment is accepted as a member of the club, whose fitness for assignments, promotions, and continued service becomes immune from challenge." The review found the CIA suffered from a system and a culture unwilling and unable, particularly in the early years of Ames's betrayal, to face, assess, and investigate the catastrophic blow Ames had dealt to the core of its operations. Former CIA counterintelligence chief James Olson felt this cultural pull deeply and personally. Decades after Ames's arrest and sentencing to life in prison, Olson is still haunted that he never said anything to the CIA's Office of Security about Ames's obvious performance issues and drinking problems when the two worked together. "The fact that I didn't step forward torments me," Olson told me in 2020. "But it's so countercultural to rat out a colleague, even a friend." Trusting too little. Paranoia. The second counterintelligence challenge is trusting too little. Skepticism, always questioning whether a source is credible, whether an asset has been turned, whether reality is what it seems, whether someone is trying to deceive you, is a job requirement for good counterintelligence. But there's a fine line between healthy skepticism and destructive paranoia. Taken too far, skepticism can create a debilitating, distrustful culture where suspicions run wild, careers get destroyed, and the truth gets lost. "It's a very dark side of the intelligence profession," noted Bill Phillips, a CIA case officer whose 25-year career included stints in counterintelligence. "I suspect that is why you do not find a lot of intelligence professionals spending their entire careers in the counterintelligence subspecialty. You can lose sleep. You can lose your sense of balance if you're not careful and if you do it for too long. You begin to see spy ghosts and double and triple agent ghosts in every case." That's exactly what happened during the Cold War, when for 20 years the CIA was caught in growing paranoia of the agency's infamous first counterintelligence chief, James Angleton. Tall and lanky, with a gaunt face, thick glasses, and spidery fingers that clutched the Virginia Slims he chain-smoked in a darkened office, Angleton was a larger-than-life figure to supporters and detractors alike. From 1954 until he was fired in 1974, Angleton ran agency counterintelligence. His curtains were always drawn, his desk covered with personal super-secret files that never made it into the CIA's official records system. An insomniac, Angleton often worked late into the night, his mind racing to find deceptions, double crosses, and secrets within secrets waged by America's enemies. Angleton once described his counterintelligence world as a wilderness of mirrors, a phrase he took from a T.S. Eliot poem. He cultivated an aura of brilliance, secrecy, and mystery, a man with an encyclopedic knowledge of Soviet operations and an unnerving habit of saying nothing at all in meetings. He grew exotic orchids at home, tied elaborate flies for his fishing trips, was fond of poetry, and was one of the CIA's heaviest drinkers. Angleton was convinced the Soviets had orchestrated a massive campaign to tie Allied intelligence services in knots by sending false defectors and planting moles inside Allied governments. In his view, almost every Soviet defector was a fake, sent to peddle misleading information, lead U.S. intelligence officials on wild goose chases, and obscure the truth. While effective early in his career at building important counterintelligence capabilities, Angleton's suspicions grew more untethered to reality over time. To be sure, Angleton had some good reasons to be suspicious. He cut his teeth in World War II, working for America's wartime intelligence service, the Office of Strategic Services. His posting to London gave Angleton a front-row seat to Britain's Operation Double Cross, a brilliant operation that identified nearly all of Germany's secret agents in England, and use them to send phony information about Allied landing plans and locations so that the actual D-Day landing at Normandy would be a surprise. After the war, thanks to a secret American program named Venona, codebreakers were able to intercept and decrypt Soviet communications. Angleton saw the transmissions that revealed the Soviet Union had placed more than 200 agents and sources inside the U.S. government, defense industries, and the media, as well as the Manhattan Project to build the atomic bomb in World War II. In 1963, Angleton was betrayed by one of his closest friends in the intelligence inner circle, none other than British intelligence officer and double agent for the Soviet Union, Kim Philby of the Cambridge Spies. Philby and Angleton had worked together since the war. It was Philby who taught Angleton the intelligence business, served as his mentor, confidant, and drinking companion for 2 decades. "It was a bitter blow he never forgot," said Angleton's wife, Cicely. Philby's treachery affected him terribly, deeply. Angleton's CIA colleagues shared his wife's assessment. "It seems almost certain that the revelation of Kim Philby's duplicity in 1963 and the experience in 1951 of uncovering 4 other Soviet agents in the service of the British had a profound effect on Angleton and his views of the KGB's capability and his propensity to believe it likely that CIA had also been penetrated at high levels," concluded a 2011 CIA study. Angleton's obsessions grew progressively worse and his actions more destructive. When a mid-level KGB officer named Anatoly Golitsyn defected to the United States in 1961 and echoed some of Angleton's conspiracy theories, Angleton was hooked. He became convinced Golitsyn had to be believed and that the vast plot was real. Angleton's obsession with Golitsyn and what critics dubbed the monster plot led Angleton and his counterintelligence staff to spend years doubting some of the most valuable intelligence of the Cold War and ruining the lives of several CIA officials in a fruitless quest for a fictitious mole nicknamed Sasha. One of Angleton's casualties was a Soviet spy named Yuri Nosenko, who defected to the United States in 1964. From the start, Angleton believed that Nosenko was a fake defector, a Soviet plant sent to trick the United States. As a result, the CIA reneged on its deal with him and imprisoned him for nearly 4 years, holding him in solitary confinement in the attic of a CIA safehouse in the United States. There, Nosenko was subjected to hostile interrogations by CIA officers seeking to get him to confess to being a Soviet ruse. He wasn't. In fact, Nosenko provided important information about Soviet agents in American and European embassies, Russian bugs planted in the American embassy in Moscow, and the Soviet file on Kennedy assassin Lee Harvey Oswald, who had lived in the Soviet Union in the 1950s and 1960s. After 3.5 years of interrogation sessions and polygraph tests, the CIA finally determined that Nosenko was telling the truth and released him with a new name and $80,000. Nosenko spent the rest of his life somewhere in the southern United States until his death in 2008. KGB records later conclusively showed that Nosenko was a genuine defector who was considered so damaging to Soviet operations, the KGB planned on executing him. By the time James Schlesinger became CIA director in 1973, Angleton was trapped in his own wilderness of mirrors, trusting almost no one and suspecting almost everyone. He was cagey, uncontrollable, isolated, and drunk. Schlesinger was so concerned that he sent a special assistant named Sam Hoskinson to talk with him. Hoskinson found Angleton in his office, chain-smoking in the dark, a single desk lamp on. Angleton spent the next 45 minutes spinning a bizarre Soviet conspiracy theory that ended by accusing the new CIA director of being a Russian spy. Stunned, Hoskinson said he would have to tell the director what Angleton had just alleged. Angleton glared back at him and replied, "Well then, you must be one of them too." Angleton's paranoia took a heavy toll on the agency. In his elusive quest for Sasha, the counterintelligence chief launched a massive mole hunt that investigated more than 50 employees. At least 16 were treated as serious suspects. The careers of three CIA officers, Richard Kovich, S. Peter Carlo, and Paul Garbler, were so damaged, Congress eventually passed a law known as the Mole Relief Act to clear their names and compensate them financially. Angleton never found a Soviet mole in America. Meanwhile, his suspicions chilled efforts to recruit spies inside the Soviet bloc. Many CIA officials, including former CIA Director William Colby, say Angleton's excessive distrust all but paralyzed the CIA's Soviet operations during the Cold War. Former CIA Director Robert Gates, who joined the agency as a Soviet specialist, wrote that Angleton, by the end of his career, had become a caricature of a counterintelligence officer. His personality and behavior became an obstacle to serious consideration of the very real problem of determining whether CIA or the U.S. government had been penetrated by a foreign intelligence service, or whether a recruited spy was real and his information valid. It is generally acknowledged that after Angleton's firing, the counterintelligence pendulum swung too far in the other direction, breeding a laxness and reluctance to raise counterintelligence alarms, one of the reasons Hansen and Ames were able to go undetected for so long. Technology challenges. The third major counterintelligence challenge is technological. New technologies are usually a double-edged sword for all aspects of the intelligence business. Counterintelligence is no exception. Massive increases in storage and computing power enable analysts to comb through data at speeds and scales unimaginable even a decade ago. But these advances also enable turncoats to do more damage, because they have more information at their fingertips. New developments in encryption and internet communications make it easier to recruit and run spies from afar. But these technologies also inject new ways for foreign counterintelligence services to discover American assets. Breaches are getting bigger, faster, better. In the old days, stealing secrets took effort. Before the internet, traitors had to sneak into files, snap pictures with hidden mini cameras, and smuggle documents out of secure buildings in their pant legs or a tissue box. The digital era has supersized the damage that one person can inflict. Today, insiders can steal classified information in terabytes, not trash bags, and do the job in days, not decades. As former CIA counterintelligence chief Olson put it, "The risk to us now as counterintelligence professionals has been greatly increased by technology. I was worried about disloyal people only walking out the door with documents. Now they walk out the door with disks." It took Robert Hansen more than 25 years to ferret out 6,000 documents and hand them to the Russians, one small garbage bag at a time. By contrast, in 2010, Army Private First Class Chelsea Manning downloaded the contents of 250,000 classified State Department cables on a fake Lady Gaga CD while lip-syncing to the song Telephone. Former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden stole an estimated 1.5 million documents containing some of the most highly classified programs in the U.S. government in just 10 months before hightailing it to Hong Kong and then Moscow in 2013. The trove was so huge, if the documents were printed and physically stacked, the pile would be 3 miles high. Snowden claims he was a whistleblower who acted out of conscience, not a traitor who acted in cahoots with a foreign power. But Snowden did not just copy what he happened to see on his desktop. A bipartisan review by the House Intelligence Committee found that Snowden sought access to classified programs by tricking coworkers into giving him their security credentials and by searching their network drives without their permission, downloading away. The vast majority of the documents he stole, the report concludes, have nothing to do with programs impacting individual privacy interests. They instead pertain to military, defense, and intelligence programs of great interest to America's adversaries. Snowden managed to download a mother load with some clicks and clever social engineering, all from the comfort of his own desktop. The breaches keep coming. In the past few years, former CIA officer Kevin Mallory was sentenced to 20 years in prison for spying for China, and an NSA contractor named Hal Martin pleaded guilty to hoarding 50 terabytes of classified materials. That's 500 million pages of information in his house, garden shed, and car. A mysterious group calling itself the Shadow Brokers somehow stole, either through a cyber attack or a human penetration, many of the National Security Agency's most valuable hacking tools and dumped them on the internet, where they have been used in global cyber attacks by North Korea and others. These stolen tools could be used for years to come by an array of nefarious actors. Once bad code is in the wild, it never really goes away. One of these weapons is called Eternal Blue, which is perhaps exactly how NSA employees are feeling in the wake of this breach. Technological breakthroughs are also introducing new computer vulnerabilities that put American assets and their handlers at risk and make mole hunting even more complicated. America's recent counterintelligence crisis in China makes this challenge all too clear. How did America's spy network in China get blown? It was late 2011, and the informant was worried. Everyone he knew in China who was secretly helping the U.S. government was getting caught by Chinese authorities and turned into double agents, or killed. He was nervous, recalled a former U.S. official. That meeting kicked off a special joint CIA-FBI counterintelligence investigation that would last years and leave lingering questions unanswered, even after the arrest of a suspected Chinese mole named Jerry Chen Xing Li. What is known is that over a two-year period, nearly all of America's spies in China were blown. The lucky ones were imprisoned. At least 20 were eventually executed. One was shot in the courtyard of a government building in China, right in front of his colleagues, just to make sure co-workers got the message. According to one account, the CIA launched secret rescue operations to ferry spies out of China. Some made it, others didn't. The last CIA case officer to meet with sources in China reportedly handed them large sums of cash. It was all that could be done. America's spy network had taken years to build, and it had suddenly turned to ash. "They wiped us out in China. All the networks we had were gone," said one former American official. The CIA had to temporarily suspend human intelligence collection in China and permanently overhaul its electronic communications system with assets worldwide. China may have shared information with Russia that blew and possibly even killed American sources there too. What caused this monumental collapse? Some believed one or more moles inside the United States government were responsible. Two American intelligence officials came under suspicion. One, a senior CIA case officer who had served in China when the network was recruited, was cleared in 2013. The other was Jerry Chen Xing Li, a naturalized American citizen who was born in Hong Kong, grew up in Hawaii, served 4 years in the U.S. Army, and spent 13 years as a CIA case officer from 1994 to 2007. His job was recruiting foreign spies to spill secrets to the United States. But instead of creating moles, evidence suggests that Li became one. After leaving the CIA, Li moved to Hong Kong, where he worked for a tobacco company and tried to start his own cigarette import business, but failed. In 2010, two Chinese nationals approached Li at a dinner in Shenzhen and said they were aware of his background, were in the same profession, and would give him a gift of $100,000 and take care of him for life in exchange for his help. The next month, Li began receiving written taskings from Chinese intelligence officers asking about sensitive CIA information. Meanwhile, Li started depositing hundreds of thousands of dollars in his bank account. In 2012, the FBI lured him back to the United States with a fake CIA job offer and conducted a court-authorized search of his belongings while he was staying in hotels in Hawaii and Virginia. FBI agents found two little books filled with secrets that included the true names of Chinese assets, operational notes from clandestine meetings, and covert facility locations. In 2019, Li pleaded guilty to one charge of conspiring to commit espionage and was sentenced to 19 years in prison. Yet, mounting evidence suggests humans were not the only weakness. The CIA's main internet-based clandestine communications system had also been penetrated. A 2018 foreign policy investigation, citing five current and former intelligence officials, first reported that the CIA had found serious technical flaws that linked a temporary communication system meant to contact unvetted news sources with the main one. The two systems were supposed to be completely separate, but they weren't. As one former official colorfully put it, the CIA fucked up the firewall. Penetration testing conducted by the NSA and FBI found that cyber experts with access to the interim system could find their way into the main one used to communicate with vetted sources. Because the two systems were first used in war zones in the Middle East, they were not designed to withstand the sophisticated cyber capabilities and heavily surveilled online environments of countries like China. Some former intelligence officials believe that only a technical breach could explain the speed and scope of the blown network in China. Iran, it should be noted, also breached the same shoddy communication system. In short, the China case suggests that counterintelligence challenges in the digital age are likely to grow more difficult, not less. The age-old human vulnerabilities of trust and paranoia are not going away. Meanwhile, human frailties are being joined by technical ones. Hidden vulnerabilities in information systems are likely to require new skills and faster action. While technical tools like signals intelligence have long played a role in counterintelligence, the 21st century counterintelligence battleground is growing ever more vast, encompassing everything from garbage bags under bridges to computer code in the far corners of cyberspace. Chapter 7, Covert Action, A Hard Business of Agonizing Choices. Are some covert actions effective? Yes, but most are not. Michael Morell, CIA Acting Director, 2011, 2012, 2013, and CIA Deputy Director, 2010 to 2013. The sun was rising over the Yemeni desert on September 30, 2011, when Anwar al-Awlaki sat down outside his Bedouin-style tent for breakfast. Tall, skinny, and wearing wire-rimmed glasses, Awlaki looked more like a professor than a killer. Someone must have heard the buzzing. Awlaki and his men started racing for their trucks. They knew what that sound meant. They knew what was coming. From another desert, 8,500 miles away, at Creech Air Force Base, just outside of Las Vegas, drone operators sitting inside a darkened trailer launched Hellfire missiles. They watched in eerie quiet, lights dim and monitors glowing, as the trucks were incinerated. Awlaki was killed, as were the three men with him, later identified as another American jihadi propagandist named Samir Khan and two tribesmen. The nondescript trailers at Creech gave nothing away. To a passerby, they weren't noteworthy in the least. but the sign at the base entrance made it clear what kind of business took place here. Home of the hunters. Anwar al-Awlaki was full of contradictions. He was an American who liked playing soccer and going fishing. Born in New Mexico to a moderate Yemeni family, Awlaki studied engineering at Colorado State University and spent half his life in the United States. Eventually, he became an imam at a prestigious mosque outside of Washington, D.C., where he was considered a leading voice of modern Islam. With three kids and a Dodge minivan, he seemed the picture of an Americanized cleric. He was invited to preach at the U.S. Capitol and the Pentagon. Shortly after 9/11, the New York Times featured Awlaki as part of a new generation of Muslim leader capable of merging East and West. But Anwar al-Awlaki also had a dark side that grew darker with time. He was a spiritual advisor to several of the 9/11 hijackers, a preacher who liked prostitutes, and an inspirational leader who increasingly targeted his own countrymen for death. A few years after 9/11, Awlaki moved to Yemen, where he assumed a leading role in al-Qaeda's offshoot there and became the most influential jihadi propagandist in the world. His radical sermons preaching hate and violence could be found all over the internet, on YouTube videos, Facebook posts, and even a glossy English-language online jihadist magazine called Inspire, which included an article titled, "Make a Bomb in the Kitchen of Your Mom." By 2009, Awlaki had moved from inspiration to operation, recruiting suicide terrorists and planning attacks. These included the underwear bomber plot to blow up Northwest Flight 253 over Detroit on Christmas Day, which was foiled when an alert passenger noticed the bomber trying to detonate his underwear. The 2011 targeted killing of Anwar al-Awlaki marked the first time since the Civil War that the U.S. government trained its firepower to hunt and kill one of its own citizens without any charges or trial. Awlaki was also the first American citizen ever marked for death by a drone strike. The operation had been conducted as a CIA covert action, which meant it didn't need congressional or judicial approval. In the strange post-9/11 legal landscape, wiretapping an American terrorist required a court order, but killing one didn't. Although the drone pilots were hunkered down in a trailer near Las Vegas, the drones themselves were launched from a secret CIA base in Saudi Arabia. Sometime in 2010, Awlaki had been put on a secret CIA kill list, and his death was approved by President Obama. But the kill list didn't stay secret for long. After word leaked to the press, Awlaki's father, a prominent Yemeni who had served as Minister of Agriculture, sued in U.S. court to get his son taken off the list. It was an extraordinary moment, a foreign national suing an American court to save the life of his American son, who was plotting to kill other American citizens. In December 2010, Awlaki's father lost his court case. 9 months later, the CIA tracked down his son and carried out the drone strike that killed him. No intelligence topic is more charged than covert action. Drone strikes are only the most recent controversy, drawing both widespread public support and fierce opposition. As former CIA Director Leon Panetta wrote, "Covert action is a hard business of agonizing choices." This chapter begins by examining what covert action is and how it works. Next, we explore why all modern presidents have used it. Then we turn to a central question. How do you judge whether covert action is worth it? And the debates it raises about efficacy and morality. Finally, we look at new challenges for intelligence posed by drone technologies and the global war on terror. Shedding light on dark corners. Covert action conjures up images of dark corner of the room activities that make people uneasy. For years, the Central Intelligence Agency has worked covertly to overthrow regimes in far-flung places. And until 1976, the CIA's covert action portfolio included targeting foreign leaders for assassination. Fidel Castro was the subject of at least 8 plots, including bizarre schemes involving mafia hitmen and exploding seashells. Some CIA officers use imagery that adds to the mystique or discomfort of covert action, depending on your view. Kofor Black, who directed the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, once told a colleague that he wanted Osama bin Laden's head shipped back in a box of dry ice. Black also assured President George W. Bush after 9/11, "When we're through with them, they will have flies walking across their eyeballs." Among Bush's closest advisors, Black came to be known as the flies on the eyeballs guy. Yet this picture misses a lot. Yes, covert action includes lethal and controversial programs, but it also includes a wide spectrum of activities, from old-fashioned propaganda to high-tech cyber sabotage. Perhaps even more striking, every modern president has resorted to covert action, even those who made human rights and democratic values pillars of their foreign policies. When different leaders with different political philosophies facing different enemies in different eras turn to the same toolkit, it's time to put preconceived notions aside and dig deeper. As we'll see, covert action is complicated and frequently misunderstood. Defining covert action, 3 words, 4 types. The National Security Act of 1947 established the CIA, but never originally mentioned covert action. Instead, for years, covert action was conducted on the basis of a vague catch-all clause in that law, authorizing the CIA to perform such other functions and duties related to intelligence affecting the national security, as the National Security Council may from time to time direct. It wasn't until the 1991 Intelligence Authorization Act that covert action was defined as an activity or activities of the United States government to influence political, economic, or military conditions abroad, where it is intended that the role of the United States government will not be apparent or acknowledged publicly. There are 3 key words in this definition. The first is influence. Covert action encompasses activities that are intended to affect outcomes in foreign countries, like swaying public opinion, assisting rebels, and sabotaging illicit nuclear weapons programs. Covert action and espionage are both done in secret, but they are not the same. Covert action is active. Its aim is to produce or affect outcomes. Espionage is more passive. Its purpose is acquiring information. The second important word is acknowledged. What makes something a covert action isn't the activity being carried out, it's the secret U.S. sponsorship of the activity. Covert action is designed so that the role of the U.S. government is not apparent or acknowledged. There needs to be plausible deniability. If something happens or some aspect of a covert operation becomes known, U.S. officials can make a believable case that they had nothing to do with it. Preserving deniability helps to minimize negative effects for the United States. It also enables nations to assist who otherwise might not, because helping the United States would be unpopular domestically or provoke retaliation by other foreign powers. Of course, many covert operations become open secrets, making plausible deniability not so plausible. And the United States often conducts the exact same activities overtly that it does covertly, including killing terrorists with drones. The point is that hiding official U.S. involvement is one of the most important features setting covert action apart from other intelligence and military activities. The other important feature is who actually conducts these activities, the CIA or the Defense Department. More on that later. The third crucial word is abroad. By law, the CIA is not allowed to conduct covert action inside the United States. That's not the case in many other nations, where intelligence services work to influence political activities not just outside their borders, but also within them. Covert activities can be classified into four broad types. The first is propaganda or information operations, which seeks to influence the beliefs and actions of a target group by disseminating information that can be true, incomplete, or deliberately false. In the Cold War, the CIA dropped propaganda from balloons and secretly funded radio broadcasts to stir dissidents behind the Iron Curtain. According to Leon Panetta, who ran the agency from 2009 to 2011, more recent CIA covert operations have sometimes tried to influence foreign media messages to change attitudes within the country before important elections. The second type of covert action is political action, which seeks to shift the balance of political forces in another country by helping friends and undermining foes, often by providing secret funding or training to political leaders, parties, or opposition groups. One of the CIA's first covert operations sought to combat communism at the polls. When the agency was created in 1947, communists had assumed power in Poland, Hungary, and Romania, and were making fast electoral inroads in Italy and France. Truman and his advisors were convinced that something had to be done. The CIA got to work laundering over $10 million in captured Axis funds and funneling it to Italy's Christian Democratic Party to win the national election. The agency covertly funded Italian politicians for the next 20 years, spending more than $65 million, or $582 million in today's terms. Italy was seen as an instant success and became a model for expanding covert election influence operations in countries around the world. Operations included supporting anti-Allende groups in Chile in the 1960s and 1970s, and Milosevic's opposition in Serbia in 2000. Political action also includes riskier and more controversial activities, like overthrowing governments directly or through surrogates, as the CIA did in Iran and Guatemala in the 1950s and in Chile in the 1970s, and as it attempted in Iraq in the 1990s. The third kind of covert activity is economic covert action, which seeks to disrupt and destabilize the economies of unfriendly regimes. These activities have included counterfeiting currency, destroying crops, and in the case of Nicaragua in the 1980s, secretly mining harbors to impede commercial shipping. Fourth and finally, paramilitary operations are the riskiest and most controversial kinds of covert action because they tend to be larger scale and violent. This is the flies on eyeballs part of the portfolio. Activities like arming, training, and advising insurgencies in secret wars, and targeted killing with drones. According to public records, during the Cold War, the CIA backed guerrillas, sponsored insurgents, and engaged in secret wars in more than 20 nations. The best known of these are the failed Bay of Pigs operation in Cuba in 1961, the secret arming of Afghan rebels after the Soviet Union invaded in 1979, and the Contra War against the Sandinista regime in Nicaragua in the 1980s. The CIA also engaged in covert assassination plots of foreign leaders until they were discovered by Congress and banned by a presidential executive order in 1976. In addition to Fidel Castro, the Senate Select Committee to Study Governmental Operations with Respect to Intelligence Activities, better known as the Church Committee, unearthed evidence that the CIA's assassination portfolio included plans to kill Congolese leader Patrice Lumumba with a special poison that simulated a local disease. The agency's chief scientist, Sidney Gottlieb, flew with the poison in his carry-on luggage and delivered it to Larry Devlin, the senior CIA officer in Leopoldville. Devlin was supposed to inject it into Lumumba's food or drink or toothpaste, but he couldn't go through with it. He ended up burying the poison vials in the banks of the Congo River. After 9/11, paramilitary operations turned toward renditions, secretly seizing suspected terrorists abroad who are wanted by the United States, and transporting them to third-party countries for detention and interrogation outside the judicial process. And they also included drone strikes. As we'll discuss later, it is getting harder to know just where the CIA's role ends and the military's role begins. Both conduct drone strikes against suspected terrorists, sometimes in the same country, sometimes against the same target, sometimes on the same team. This much, however, is clear. Drone strikes have been a major tool of the past three presidential administrations. According to one expert study, President George W. Bush authorized approximately 50 drone strikes in Yemen, Pakistan, and Somalia during his presidency, which killed nearly 300 terrorists and nearly 200 civilians. The Obama administration carried out more than 500 drone strikes in those countries, killing more than 3,000 terrorists and nearly 400 civilians over 8 years. And in the first 2 years of the Trump administration, approximately 200 strikes were carried out against targets there, killing an estimated 1,000 people. None of these figures count drone strikes on the hot battlefields of Iraq, Afghanistan, or Syria. Covert action and its overt counterparts. One of the biggest misperceptions of covert action is that it involves a unique set of bad activities that are so troubling they must be hidden from view. In reality, nearly all covert activities have overt counterparts. We just don't think about them. During the Cold War, propaganda behind the Iron Curtain was produced both by Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, which were covertly backed by the CIA, as well as by the Voice of America, which was openly sponsored by the U.S. government to tell America's story. The CIA has covertly funneled support to pro-democracy political candidates and groups abroad. Meanwhile, the congressionally financed National Endowment for Democracy has been doing the same thing openly since the 1980s. Covert economic action seeks to undermine foreign economies. Economic sanctions are imposed openly and deliberately for the same goal, hitting them where it hurts. Covert regime change operations are called coups. Overt ones are called wars. When American troops fight in places like Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya, the reason usually isn't to keep existing leaders in power. In 1998, Congress even passed a law called the Iraq Liberation Act, which telegraphed bipartisan intent to oust Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. It should be the policy of the United States to support efforts to remove the regime headed by Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq and to promote the emergence of a democratic government to replace that regime, the law declared. To help get the job done, Congress authorized $97 million to support Iraqi opposition groups. Regime change does not get much more overt than that. Even paramilitary operations come in both covert and overt varieties. The CIA launched covert operations to assassinate Castro and Lumumba. In 1986, President Ronald Reagan ordered airstrikes that narrowly missed killing Libyan strongman Muammar Gaddafi. Reagan went on national television just to make sure everyone knew the strikes were retaliation for a Libyan-sponsored terrorist attack in West Berlin that had targeted American service members. In recent years, the United States has tried to roll back suspected nuclear weapons programs by using covert cyber operations against Iran and by openly declaring war against Iraq. While many drone strikes off the hot battlefield in places like Yemen, Pakistan, and Somalia have been carried out by the CIA as covert action, in 2020, a drone strike killing Qasem Soleimani, Iran's top military and intelligence official, was carried out openly by the U.S. military. The Trump administration took full and immediate responsibility. Why go covert? If covert action looks so much like overt action, then why do presidents ever use it? And why has every modern president found it so indispensable? It's not because American presidents are so much alike. 13 presidents have served from the end of World War II to 2020. 7 were Republicans, 6 were Democrats. They hailed from every region of the country and had a wide range of prior careers in acting, farming, law, real estate, academia, the military, even men's clothing. One, Eisenhower, was a 4-star general and war hero, while several, Clinton, Obama, and Trump, never served in the military. George H.W. Bush was steeped in intelligence, having previously served as CIA director and vice president. Donald J. Trump had no exposure to intelligence and had never served in any governmental office before becoming president. 8 presidents held office during the Cold War. 5 served after the Soviet Union collapsed, when terrorists, rogue states, failed states, cyber dangers, global climate change, and rising competitors like China filled the threat landscape. Yet despite these differences, every president, from Truman to Trump, has authorized covert action, even the dark corner of the room variety. If you had to bet which presidents would embrace covert action, you'd probably put your money on hawkish Republicans. And you would be wrong. Well, not entirely wrong. Ronald Reagan increased the use of covert action in the 1980s. But Jimmy Carter and Barack Obama, both Democrats who made averting wars and promoting human rights mainstays of their foreign policy agendas, turned to covert action as much as or more than their Republican predecessors. In 1976, Carter ran for president against the national disgraces of Watergate, Vietnam, and the CIA, and he vowed never to do anything as president that would be a contravention of the moral and ethical standards that I would exemplify in my own life as an individual. He initially slashed covert action budgets, but the Iranian hostage crisis and Soviet invasion of Afghanistan changed his mind. On November 4, 1979, Iranian revolutionaries sacked the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and held 52 American diplomats and other government employees hostage for 444 agonizing days. The hostage crisis consumed the nation. Across America, yellow ribbons were everywhere. An homage to the 1973 hit song about a prisoner coming home, "Tie a Yellow Ribbon Round the Old Oak Tree." CBS News anchor Walter Cronkite signed off each nightly broadcast by counting the number of days the hostages had been in captivity. Carter vowed not to travel abroad or campaign for re-election until they were freed. To many, it seemed that Carter had become a hostage too. Negotiations went nowhere, and the administration looked feckless. CIA Director Stansfield Turner wrote that it was little consolation to the American public that we had frozen Iran's assets. The president had to do more. He turned to secret operations, authorizing the CIA's daring rescue of 6 Americans hiding in the Canadian embassy and a second military rescue to free the other hostages inside the U.S. embassy. But the big rescue operation, codenamed Eagle Claw, ended in fiery disaster when a helicopter collided with a C-130, killing 8 service members before they ever reached Tehran. The hostage crisis coincided with a superpower crisis, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which Carter described as the most serious threat to the peace since the Second World War. 2 days after Soviet troops rolled into Kabul and killed Afghan leader Hafizullah Amin, Carter authorized his first covert action to arm Afghan Mujahideen rebels. "Our ultimate goal," wrote National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski in a January 2, 1980 memo, "is the withdrawal of Soviet troops from Afghanistan. Even if this is not attainable, we should make Soviet involvement as costly as possible." It would become the largest covert operation of the Cold War, costing billions and leading to a Soviet withdrawal. By the time Carter left office, he had approved nearly as many covert operations as Nixon and Ford had. Carter's CIA director, Stansfield Turner, later wrote that the Carter administration, despite its dedication to human rights and its considerable reservations about the morality of covert actions, turned easily and quickly to covert devices to respond to some of these despotic acts. Barack Obama was another president who spoke passionately about promoting human rights. Obama, a former constitutional law professor, ranked among the more liberal Democratic members of the Senate when he ran for president. He also vowed to make American democratic values a cornerstone of American foreign policy. "We can hold true to our values and in so doing advance those values abroad," he declared in a major foreign policy campaign speech. Obama was determined to end America's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, wind down the CIA's controversial detention and interrogation program, and combat terrorism. Meeting all three goals left few options. Obama turned to drone strikes because, as he put it, doing nothing is not an option. And by narrowly targeting our action against those who want to kill us, we are choosing the course of action least likely to result in the loss of innocent life. 3 days after taking office, he authorized his first CIA drone strikes in northwest Pakistan. Obama ended up dramatically expanding the targeted killing program, authorizing 10 times more drone strikes against suspected terrorists than his Republican predecessor, George W. Bush. The enduring allure of covert action. Three reasons explain the enduring allure of covert action. First, covert action offers presidents a third option in between doing nothing and sending in the Marines. It's a toolkit to get things done when combat looks too risky and other policy levers look too weak. Presidents may be unique in many respects, but they are alike in one important way. They have a preference for action. They know that legacies are made by big changes and new directions, not maintaining the status quo. "President Jones carefully kept everything exactly the same" is never the description a president wants in history books. Imagine, for example, how history would have remembered Carter if the Iran hostage rescue mission had succeeded. Nor are presidents comfortable sitting idly by while adversaries invade neighbors, harm Americans, and destabilize the world. It's one thing to consider covert action on the campaign trail, quite another in the Oval Office. Shouldering the responsibilities of office has a way of changing perspective. Senator Frank Church, who led the Congressional Committee investigating CIA abuses in the 1970s, wrote that once the capability for covert activity is established, the pressures brought to bear on the president to use it are immense. The second factor is feasibility. Concealing the U.S. government's role through covert action is sometimes the only possible path to success. If the United States had openly financed Italy's Christian Democratic Party in 1948, voters would have seen the party as an American puppet, and the communists would likely have won the election. In 1979, if word ever got out that the Canadian movie team traveling to Tehran to make a movie named Argo was actually a covert operation to rescue six Americans who had taken refuge in the Canadian embassy during the Iranian Revolution, the diplomats could have been captured or killed. Covert action is never a president's first choice of action. Sometimes, however, it's the only viable choice. The third reason for the enduring allure of covert action is that the plausible deniability of U.S. involvement in a covert action can limit retaliation and escalation. Particularly during the Cold War, when the two superpowers were locked in a global geopolitical and ideological battle and were pointing nuclear warheads at each other's cities, the pressure was on to find ways of competing without unleashing nuclear war. Plausible deniability proved valuable, even when it wasn't terribly plausible. Both the United States and the Soviet Union engaged in proxy wars in which both sides knew the other was secretly backing local groups, but officially pretended they did not know in order to manage escalation risks. During the Korean War, for example, Soviet pilots covertly engaged in air-to-air combat against Americans, and U.S. intelligence agencies knew it. Yet, to prevent crisis escalation, neither side let on that direct combat was occurring. Similarly, the massive American covert operation to support the Afghan Mujahideen against the Soviets became an open secret by 1984, and yet, the Reagan administration refused to officially acknowledge U.S. support for two more years. Officials even insisted on supplying the Mujahideen with Soviet-made weapons to maintain the cover story. Why? Because even the pretense of covertness kept the conflict from escalating into a superpower war and provided cover for partners like Pakistan and Egypt to assist U.S. efforts without facing retaliation by the Soviets. As Berkowitz and Goodman wrote, the fact that covertness is sometimes no more than a fig leaf does not necessarily alter the fact that it is a useful fig leaf. The useful fig leaf played a role in the 2011 bin Laden operation, too. Robert Gates, who was serving as Secretary of Defense at the time, wrote that regardless of whether the raid succeeded or failed, sending an American military team into sovereign Pakistani territory without Pakistani knowledge or permission could jeopardize an already fragile relationship, and thus the fate of the war in Afghanistan. If the operation was carried out under Defense Department authorities, the U.S. government could not deny involvement. But if the CIA was in charge, it could. Conducting the raid as a CIA covert operation offered, in Gates's words, at least a fig leaf, granted, a very small leaf, of deniability. One CIA official involved in the hunt for bin Laden put it more directly. If the military did it, we could have been at war with Pakistan.